talk about, does Stable Combinatorial has anything to say about Hobano homology?
Thank you very much. Thank you for staying for my talk. And thank you also to Anna for organizing a very nice Swiss Knots conference. The work I want to talk about is part of an ongoing collaboration with Brent Everett, and more recently has involved Hans-Werner Henn. So the work I'm interested in is motivated by a rather simple-minded question, which is this. If you take your favorite quantum invariant, of which mine happens to be Kolmogorov homology, then to each object within a certain class, you associate some invariant quantity. For example, you take a knot, and to that knot, you might associate a number, a polynomial, or in the case of Kolmogorov homology, a graded abelian group. So given such a thing, you can ask, given an object within the class, say a knot, can you produce a space whose classical invariants give you back your invariant? So in this case, what classical invariants do we know that produce graded abelian groups from the spaces? Well, you might think of homology groups, perhaps homotopy groups, and of course there are many other ways. The idea being that here at the bottom you have something classical, so this space is going to encode whatever kind of crazy geometry or quantum invariant is actually measured. So this is a nice question, but it's also an extremely hard question, about which I nor anyone else for that matter can say very much. But one thing that we can do, or at least I want to do in the case of Kolmogorov homology, is to weaken the question to the point where we can at least say something. So for Kolmogorov homology, what do we do? Well, for a start, we start with a knot diagram, and then we produce what I'll call the Kolmogorov cube. And I have to thank both Lou Kaufman and Matt in the last talk for reminding you what the Kolmogorov cube is. It's the decorated hypercube cube of resolutions that one sees all the time in the construction of Kolmogorov homology. And this is the kind of combinatorial input, if you like. And from this, you produce a cochain complex, which gives you the Kolmogorov homology. So what I want to do is I want to push the originally very interesting question slightly in this direction to this point here. So I want to ask the question, given the same kind of combinatorial input, namely the Kolmogorov cube, can we produce a space whose classical invariants are, this gives Kolmogorov homology? Now this is a far less interesting question than the first question. Okay, I say that straight away. But nonetheless, by studying it, perhaps there are some things that we can learn. Okay? And in this talk, I want to give one approach to this, and the classical invariant that's going to show up is actually just homotopy groups. Okay, so we've already heard quite a bit about Kolmogorov homology and its construction. Let me just, first of all, I'll tell you some things about Kolmogorov homology, beginning with some things that you probably know, leading to some things that you probably don't know. So we heard how to define Kolmogorov homology, you start with a cube of resolutions. So, from my point of view, what I want to do is I want to view this, the cube at least, as a Boolean lattice. So B, the Boolean lattice on the set of crossings. So what does the Boolean lattice mean? The Boolean lattice on a set is simply the set of subsets partially ordered by inclusion. Coset of subsets and the partial order of inclusion. And so this thing is a hypercube, it's the usual cube you see. But it can also be viewed as a category. Is this level still okay? Just, okay. I promise not to give any dollar. So how do you view this as a category? Well, the objects of this category are just the elements of this subset. So the objects and the elements of B. And the morphisms, which I'll write up here. So there's a morphism, there's a unique morphism from X to Y. Whenever X is less than or equal to Y in the partial order. So if you regard a hypercube in this way, then the cube of resolutions, or the decorated cube of resolutions, which we've seen a couple of times, is in fact nothing other than a functor, you call it FKH. So this now depends on a diagram. You have some number of crossings, you take the Boolean lattice on the set of crossings. You consider that coset as a category. And we have a functor from there to abelian groups. So this is the data given by the decorated hypercube, which you see in the definition of Kamal homology. Starting with this, then, you follow a certain procedure. You have to do something with signs. You make a cochain complex, and then the homology of that cochain complex leads you to Kovalan homology.
Wait, what's the abelian group in that first box?
The abelian group here?
Yeah.
The abelian group is just the decoration at a vertex of the cube.
I see, okay.
So to each complete smoothing, to each Kaufman state, you have some vector space associated, and this functor simply takes you, this Boolean lattice is indexing those Kaufman states, and you simply associate the vector space. Well, that would be interesting.
So the structure of the coset structure, I mean, if you have something that's at level like 0000, that's, I mean, that has an unique morphism of 1, 1, 1, 1, 1.
Yes.
Not much 1, 1, 1, 1. That's plenty of models. Yeah, different maps.
No, the composition is defined, so there's unique.
Yeah, okay.
So if you take...
composition be different with that?
There's a set on two elements. Here you've got the set on AB. Here you've got AB. And the definition of the category is that there's a single morphism. So that this composition is the same as this composition. Okay, so that is, in a sense, the standard picture of how you can construct Kamal homology, at least on its input. So now I want to tell you some things that you probably don't know, giving you a slightly different view of how one might define Kamal homology, but starting from the same point. So the first thing I want to do is I want to slightly modify the Boolean lattice. I want to modify it in the following way. So if I have a piece of Boolean lattice that looks like this, that's the bottom. I want to add an additional element which is minimal. And I want this additional minimal element to be less than everything else which covers it, which is one place up. So let me call this process P. It carries on. I guess I can add the functor. I want to extend the functor here to this process P, and I do that in the most simplified way. I simply define, let's call this element eta, and I associate, so I extend this functor to P by attaching to this addition element the trivial. I'll just write zero, the trivial. So this, these maps are just the inclusion of the trivial group. So it's a very, very minor change which I made. And if you're used to the usual construction of Kalman homology, then you'll see that you can actually still do the construction that you know and love, because if you flatten this cube, as you're supposed to do, then of course I'm adding on a trivial group, something, nothing, and everything works out. But nonetheless, what I'm about to say, it's important to make this very, very minor change. One thing that occurs if I make this minor change is the following. So this is an observation that if I take the group which lives in degree zero, so I should say I'm interested for the moment in what I might call unnormalized Kalman homology. So it's at the bottom of the picture here, this is the thing that's really in degree zero. I'm not shifting. And up here I put things in degree one. This is unnormalized. So the observation is that the unnormalized Kalman homology of this input data is isomorphic to the inverse limit of this functor f to h over the post of p. Well, this is a very the bar means unnormalized. So this is a very minor use, if you like, of the inverse limit. I have something that's finite, okay? But nonetheless, you can check fairly easily that this is indeed true. If the thing that I get down the bottom is degree zero, is the inverse limit of this diagram of the groups. And it's at this point that, or this is the first point at which I actually need this additional element. It's not true if I don't have this additional element. Yes?
Is this like shallowability for process? Does this new one have it?
So the notion of shallowability is could be relevant at some point to the story. I mean, it's not relevant here, no.
And once again, there's an arrow from the neutral element to everything.
Yeah.
Including this, the zero level or not?
But not that.
Not that.
So there are two minimum.
Okay. Levels. Okay.
Okay, so we've made this observation that in zero we have something which can be described by the inverse limit.
So what is the inverse limit, will you say?
Sorry?
Will you say what it means, inverse limit of the functor?
Yeah, sure. So I have a bunch of abelian groups which are organized by diagram. Okay. So I choose an element from each of the groups, but those elements must match up under these maps. So you see fairly quickly that it all reduces down to this first level. And because you've got the zero here, you see that you get the right map for the zero command. You end up with the wrong thing. You end up with the thing. You need the kernel of what's going on here, and if you don't. Okay, so the inverse limit is a nice functor. So let's think about the inverse limit for a few seconds. It's a left exact functor. If you consider functors of this form here, then the inverse limit is left exact. So the inverse limit goes from functors from roots, and it's left exact. It's not right exact, but because it's not right exact, it's allowed to have right derived functors. So the right derived functors of anything, defined by taking objective resolution in the right place, applying your functor, in this case the inverse limit, and then taking the homology of the resulting complex. They are standard nourishment for homological. Why do I tell you this? Well, for the following reason.
Theorem with Brent Everett tells us that the unnormalized Kolmogorov homology group of degree I is in fact the ith right derived functor of the inverse limit of FKH over the category P or poset P. So, our observation, which at level zero was trivial, actually turns out to be relevant because it extends in this very nice way. By now, you might be thinking that, you know, what's he doing? We understand the Kolmogorov homology. The definition is very nice. What's he doing introducing something much far more complicated? So perhaps I should spend a moment justifying this point of view. So it is true that it turns the definition into something more complicated, but it also in some ways makes it more common. Because you see many cohomology theories that you already know are defined as right-derived functors. Group cohomology is the right-derived functors of some Hom functor. Sheaf cohomology, right-derived functors of the global sections functor. Hochschild homology, the right derived functors, it's an X group and some appropriate category. So many cohomology theories that you know and love are actually defined as right derived functors of something. So, the kind of tools and methods that we might have available to study Kolmogorov homology might be expanded by having such a description. The second point is that you compute right derived functors of anything using injective resolutions. Now, perhaps if you're clever, maybe for a certain class of knot, you might be able to come up with a particularly nice injective resolution, so it may actually really help you with some computations. Third reason is that you have a kind of, you have various kinds of functoriality. You can, if you have a poset map at this level here, you change your poset, and you change your sheaf in some natural way, then you can still define the objects on the right here. So it puts you into a context which is in some way a lot more flexible. You can take some poset map, take the induced map, and maybe change the sheaf, sorry, I shouldn't say sheaf, change the functor, and perhaps that also allows you some additional way of even calculating the Kolmogorov homology. But finally, for the fourth reason that it's interesting for me, at any rate, is that I need this later on in the talk.
Change than I guess the classic justification for Venus extensions?
Well, you can take yourself completely out of the context. I mean, if you're in Kármán homology, you're somehow stuck with these Boolean lattices.
Yeah.
Whereas here you could map in any post that you want. You're freeing yourself from being stuck to Boolean lattices, which is actually a kind of considerable advantage. Okay, well, also in my title was homotopy theory, so perhaps I should say something about homotopy theory. So the world of homotopy theory is a very nice place to inhabit for a while. It gives you a very flexible view of what a space is, which affords all sorts of possible advantages. But sometimes it's a little too flexible for its own good, and sometimes things which you would hope would work don't work. Let me give you an example. Push-outs don't work properly. If you have a following situation, you have the boundary of a disk included in, well, an S1 included into the boundary here, and an S1 included into the boundary here. Of course, you can take the push out of spaces, and what you end up getting is you have two disks, you glue them along the boundary, so the push out here is S2. But we're working in the homotopy theory world, so we'd like to be able to deform the input data, which was this bit here, and still get the same thing. But if you take the following information, the disk is contractible. So here we have a homotopic input. If we take the push out here, we're just joining two points along the point, so the push out here is just point. And of course, S2 does not have the same homotopy type as a point, as any primary school child will tell you. However, this particular mountain was scaled by homotopy theorists in the 1970s, even perhaps the late 60s. And they produced kind of homotopy theoretic version of push-outs, and more generally of limits and co-limits. So you have the same problem. Here I've given you a push-out, but you have the same problem for pullbacks, co-limits, and limits. So in the early 70s, particularly in the work of Bousfield and Kármán, they produced a homotopy version of co-limit, homotopy co-limit, and homotopy limit. Now, for the purposes of this talk, we're interested in homotopy limit, and we're just going to view this as a kind of black box. Okay, so it's something which has some input, and it also has some output. And the input is going to be a diagram of spaces. That's really, what do I mean by that? I mean a functor from some category, some small category of spaces. Okay, so for each object in your category, you can think about a poset if you want. For each element of the poset, you have a space map. But then along the edges, you have maps of spaces. So the input is such a thing. And the output it's a space. And we'll call this colon of the function F over the category C. So this is something which is a well-studied object in homotopy theory. But for us, we'll just view it as a kind of black box.
Did you work with spaces, or are you specifically working with spectra?
I'll come to spectra. So now we have this big black box, us. And so, as children, you know, attracted to a new toy, we want to try and play with this new thing that we have. So what can we do? Well, we don't actually have a functor from category to spaces, but we do have, in fact, a functor FKH from some coset to abelian groups. And there's a way of turning abelian groups into spaces, which is standard in algebraic topology, which is to take, pick a natural number n, and then you take Eilenberg plane space functor. So again, if you're not familiar with this, don't worry, it's just it's a procedure for taking an abelian group and producing a space, characterized by the fact that the nth homotopy group of the space you produce is the abelian group that you started with, and all other homotopy groups are true. So there's this nice function, depending on n. So let's call this f and n. So now we have a functor from the category, which we're interested in, which goes to spaces. So we can feed it into the machine over there, and out comes the monotopy limit of Fn over the coset P. Fine. So, as a visual experience, this wasn't awfully exciting. However, here's a result from Bausfeld and Kahn, which should get you interested again. Perhaps we should give a name to our space we've made over here. Let's call this a YN. So we can use the result of Bausfeld and Kahn using the functor FKH, which we're interested in, and then my I of the space we just made over there of YN, which is isomorphic to the N minus I right derived functor of the inverse limit FKH over P, which is, by the previous result, isomorphic to the unnormalized Gaussian homology in degree n minus I of the diagram we had at the beginning. So, by passing through all this homotopy theory, somehow, apparently by accident, we have actually stumbled across a space, if we choose n to be big enough, space such that the homotopy groups of the space B
give us at least the unnormalized graph on order. Okay, so that's already something. Of course, we're not happy with this for many reasons, but one of the reasons we're not happy with this is because what you'd really like is, if you're producing a space, you would like it to be some kind of invariant, in particular perhaps it's homotopy type ought to be an invariant. So we're going to have to go back and take more seriously what we ignored at the start, which was the fact that we're treating unnormalized graphs.
Kind of
punctuality
at the stage between
for
Planck
of Buddhism? Yeah, so that I don't know at all. Okay, so now we have to take more seriously shifts and invariants. So we want something which is invariant, and we know that the ordinary homology requires some kind of shift to make it invariant. So the usual shift is if we let C minus of D with a number of negative crossings. So we orient the diagram and we let this be the number of negative crossings. Then we define a normalized graph homology in DBI is what we had before, the unnormalized guy, in the same degree plus the number of negative crossings. So we normalize the number. So given that we're producing a space based on this, what we should ask ourselves is, can we implement these shifts at the level of our spaces? So is there an operation on spaces which induces shifts at the level of homotopy? Shifts us the wrong way. But then comes some more good news. And the good news, so the shifting we do have is taking the loop space. It shifts the wrong way. So what we need to do is we need to have some kind of anti-shifting, delooping. And the good news is that there's an entire area of mathematics devoted to making delooping work, and that is called stable homotopy theory. So stable homotopy is a vast area of mathematics. 8 minutes past 6 on the 4th day of the conference, is that's not such a great time to talk about. But fortunately, there's a kind of easy way in, which is completely sufficient for the purposes of my talk. Infinite loop space is simply a sequence of spaces such that the ith space is the loop space of the one ahead of it. So there's one version of stable holotropy theory which is based on infinite loop spaces. If we have such a such an object, so these are the basic objects of the category. Now, if we have such an object, we can perhaps form the loop space. How might we do that? Well, what would be the ith space in the loop space of this infinite loop space? Well, it would make sense to take the loop space of the ith space we see in the sequence, but the loop space of the ith space in the sequence is, in fact, the I minus first space. So in fact, taking the loop space gives us a shift in a certain direction. But we can now also shift in the other direction. It's a slightly more subtle operation. But what do? We can now d-loop, and what's the ith space in the d-looping of this loop space? Well, we just start one place along, so it's the shift in the other direction. So if we work with infinite loop spaces, we have both looping and d-looping. And we can define the holotropy groups of an infinite loop space as follows. So this is the definition. We take I plus n or I plus k, xk, k big N. So that's how we define holotropy groups of these objects. And you should notice that in fact this definition makes sense both for positive I but also for negative I. Okay, so infinite loop spaces can have both positive and negative holotropy groups. Okay, so these are the objects that we want to work with. As I said before, they form some version of stable holotropy theory. Do we have an infinite loop space? Well, we have a family. And the family is the family that's called Y dot. Family is y0, y1, y2, and so on. This is the 4. Remember that the spaces we made depended on a natural number. If we took the Einberg Lefebvre space functor for a particular n, so we do have a family of spaces. We have an infinite loop space. Well, let's see what happens if we try and consider the loop space of y I plus 1. Well, by definition, y I plus 1 is the homotopy limit of what we call f I plus
plus 1 over P, which is the same thing as, what was the definition of Fi plus 1? We took the Coulomb functor, FKH, our input information, and then we applied the island over plane space functor. But now there's a piece of homotopy theory that works in our favor, namely that homotopy limits and loop spaces commute. Okay. So this gives us the same thing as homotopy limit of loops of K plus 1 H, but by a standard result in homotopy theory, if you take the loops on an island over the plane space, you get the island over the plane space one step down. So this guy here is actually Ki. So by definition of, I think I is, oh, that's right. So this is Olin P of Fi, which by definition is y up. And within this computation here, things are happening up to homotopy, but because we're taking a homotopy limit, and homotopy limits are designed to be robust with respect to deformations by homotopy, this computation goes through. So now we have an infinite loop space. We are free to deloop it as we are any infinite loop space. So we make the following definition. X dot of V will be the infinite loop space Y dot of V, where we deloop by the number of negative crosses. And then for this infinite loop space, it turns out that it's actually the minus ith homotopy group of this thing agrees with the normalized Coulomb homology degree I. So then you have the obvious conjecture, which is actually more than a conjecture. I should probably call it something like a 70% theorem. This is with a Evers and Hans Werner Henn. And that is that if you have two diagrams representing the same knot, then the resulting infinite loop spaces are homotopy free. So maybe this is, maybe I should end here, but perhaps let me end just with a summary. So I think that the two things that you should take away from this talk. So what did we learn? I promised that we might learn something. Well, what have we learned? Well, I think one of the things that we learned, probably the most important thing actually, was this description in terms of the right derived numbers. I really think that would be important. And the second thing is, even though it's not clear, maybe, just maybe, that stable homotopy theory does actually have something to do with Coulomb homology. Okay, I'll stop there.
Questions? Yes. Are you going to provide a homotopy equivalence, or are you just going to provide an isomorphism between the homotopy groups?
Well, you need to provide a... I want to provide a homotopy... We're going to provide a homotopy equivalence. But if you have a candidate map, then you can use what's it called? The Whitehead theorem.
Right.
So you know, in fact, that the homotopy groups are the same. So you are isomorphic. Okay. So you just have to produce a map which induces the isomorphism.
If the conjecture is true, wouldn't you get lots and lots more invariants from operations in that homotopy theory?
Well,
Yes and no. I mean, yes in the sense that if you do have a space which is like this, then you could apply any invariant from algebraic topology like you take the elliptic cohomology of these things if you want, and the theory that gives you some not invariant. But you wouldn't gain very much from doing that. You could define some things. These spaces are pretty horrible. They're very, very big, for one thing. So I think that practically the spaces are not so interesting, but the fact that they exist perhaps is interesting.
Just could this give some ideas on some extra structure on the Coven homology you could get from the combinatorics?
Well, again, you could try that. I think it would be rather hard to extract it, I think. You can just take the ordinary cohomology of these spaces. Cohomology is a ring, but I doubt...
That's a cohomology operation?
Yeah, the cohomology operations. But I really doubt that any of that, even if you could do it, I doubt it's going to give you stuff that's invariant. I mean, it might. There might be some very weak thing which is going to give you some new information. But you shouldn't underestimate the how unwieldy these spaces are.
Is there something special about Coven homology? I mean, why not not follow homology?
If you've been tracking everything I've said, then you'll see that there's not very much that depends actually on Coven homology. No, I mean, the input was this functor. It was the specific setup that we had for Coven homology. But as we learned, I think in Stefan's talk, that there's also this kind of same description of a decorated Boolean lattice for Hegard first, so you can try that there as well. Yeah. It is quite a general procedure. Yes.
So what does 70% theorem mean? I mean, does it mean you have Rademacher 1 and 2 but not 3, or
it means that
that would be 66.
It means that 90% of Rademacher 1. We do need some homotopy theory to do it. We have maybe 50% of Rademacher 2, and we think the rest will work. Yeah. If you want to dispute this amount, I'll adjust it. Whatever you want. Yes.
I don't want to dispute the amount, but I mean, is it, like, I was just again asking about the naturality of the useful can construction. I mean, is that somehow understanding that seems like it could be a way to just. I don't know if you could, I guess, you talk a little bit about the techniques used in this.
About the techniques of how we might prove this more than 70%.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like I said, there's actually not. I mean, somehow we. There's nothing very exciting in the proof, really. I mean, you try and produce a map. Right? You try and produce a map from XD to XD prime, and then you produce a map like this, where you look at the algebraic proof of the invariant homology, okay, and you see if you can find that map and pass it through the whole construction. And then you have to show that this map induces an isomorphism on homotopy groups. Now you know that they are isomorphic, because that's the because they're isomorphic to homology. But then you have to prove that these are isomorphic, and you have to use some homotopy theory.
You want to show that's an equivalence, don't you? Maybe a homotopy equivalence.
You want to show that this, if you have an isomorphism in homotopy groups, which is induced by an actual map, then that's a homotopy equivalence. Yes?
Well, you have two dimensions, bigraded group, so one grade.
Yeah, so what happened to the other grading? It's not there at all. So the Q grading has been suppressed from the entire story, and that's the way it is. The Q grading is just not present. But that's actually not so bad. I mean, the Coven homology without the Q grading still affects the unknown. you can forget the Q grading and you still retain a lot of information. Yes?
Are there any group actions? I mean, do you have seen a place where you see a group action in here?
No, I haven't thought about that.
What is the hypothesis on the 70% theorem? Is it that you would have some thing that looked like Carvano homology that was known to be invariant under the randomizer moves, or you're assuming the specific TQFT that drives the boundaries?
No, there's nothing specific to the TQFT. So
there's a related question about where Drawer's categorical version of Carvano homology might fit into this, but you don't go directly to an algebra.
Right. So I guess we use Drawer's picture somehow. Well, I mean, one way of seeing what this map should be is to use Drawer's picture.
Does that behave anyhow on the connected sum of diagrams?
Well, it should do the right thing. I mean, it should give you a product. I think.
I didn't quite follow the conception, but how is it related if I just took the product of the k pi n's where pi's are the Carvano?
Yeah, okay.
Could it be that x dot is just this product?
Yeah, so this is a good question. So there is a way, if you take these abelian groups, the x on the right hand side, the Carvano homology groups, then you could apply the, I don't know, Klein space factor and say, I'm done,
that's
I've done this, right? Yes, that's right, you could do that. I don't think that that it's that trivial, no. I mean, in general, taking these homotopy limits is not that trivial. I mean, I can't, I suppose I should prove the result that says it's not that, but I'm fairly sure that it is not as trivial as doing that. That would be extremely disappointing.
More questions? Comments? Is there a Skype relation defined on this?
Well, probably. I mean, probably there's a vibration of spaces which is, you know, represents the Skype relation. Yeah. I mean, that if you have a, you know, in homotopy theory, you have long exact sequences, and I would expect that precisely you can get the usual Skein along these exact sequences that you see in Carvano homology at the level of these spaces using the vibration.
Other questions? Well, let's thank the speaker again.